Okay, we've got Bret Hart on the line right now. Let's go to Calgary, Canada. Bret, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing really good. We've also got Brian Alvarez on the line. Brian, say hi to Bret.
Hey, how's it going?
How you doing, Brian?
I guess the first thing that we should bring up and that everyone's curious is what's basically your injury status? I know that you you went to the doctors, a couple of doctors probably last week, and what have you learned and what's the prognosis?
Well, right now I'm out till at least July. There's no change in that. They've ruled out any kind of wrestling at all till then. And there's no real change in that for right now. I just sort of take it one day at a time. They wait to see. You know, so far they've been really accurate, and I've learned, the one thing I've learned through this whole thing is I've kind of lost that ability to sort of diagnose myself. You know, I kept trying to do that early and kept thinking that it wasn't that serious, that I was actually, you know, better than I thought. And now I realize after, you know, having been through it, that I'm a lot like Eric Lindros. I really just didn't know what I was doing. And I was hurt, I think, a lot worse than anyone understood, including me. So as far as things that I've done, like I've had brain scans, balance tests, and all kinds of stuff, but there's no real change in the actual confession. I still have a little bit of trouble with my speech, but not too much. My recall is much better, but you can just tell being me that it's still a little off. And your short-term memory, like I get a headache from flash bulbs or lights, or can even be a loud sound or slam doors, and you'll end up, you don't notice it at first, you know, even if you're driving in traffic and you're kind of whipping your head around and stuff like that, you don't notice it at first until a few, maybe an hour or so later, that you got a huge migraine headache. So you just, you know, you may appear fine or look fine, but you're, you know, you're really messed up, and it's been the most frustrating and most worrisome injury I think I've ever had. So hope that helps you a little bit.
This is pretty much the first potential career-ending injury you had, right?
Yeah. None of them were career-ending. And again, people, you know, they underestimate concussions. Like, you know, I know for a fact that. You know, there's clearly no way right now, under any circumstance, that I could wrestle or do anything close to it. It's that bad. And it has been a scary injury. I've had people, you know, interpret things their own way. I've had, you know, people go, well, what's he doing at a hockey game? Well, a hockey game doesn't bother me. I can focus on things. My concentration is okay, but it does tend to cause, you know, you get a headache from, you know, worrying about something or concentrating too hard on something. You know, if I relax and I'm really totally relaxed, you know, I can almost feel like I don't have a concussion at all. But it's, you know, unfortunately for me, the last few months it's been really very hard to relax, and it's been really hard for me to, you know, because of course it was much worse. It gets a little bit better all the time, so you're really out of whack with yourself. You have to just step back. Quit trying to diagnose yourself. I haven't lifted a weight. I can't work out. I can't do any exercise. I even had where I was bent over tying my shoe as an example, and it kind of got in the knot. And I didn't think much of it. I just kind of fiddled around with it and did it. By the time I got up, I felt like I was going to pass out or fall down. You just get so lightheaded. And those are all things that I think can happen to just about anybody. You know, everyone kind of gets up too fast sometimes, and you wonder where you draw the line between sort of overreacting, getting paranoid. But the concussion is something once you sort of live through what I've lived through, you really realize I've been in a funk for quite a few months, and it's been pretty scary.
Do you think pretty much that you got it when you got the kick from Goldberg, or do you think you may have come in and re-injured at that point, or maybe because, you know, you had a couple of matches afterwards where you took some headshots that maybe, I mean, could it have been a dual concussion, or do you attribute it all to that one blow?
It's about seven blows. He thought it was six or seven different blows. But I'd say I took at least three. And watching my match back with Bill Goldberg in Starcade, I took three in the match with Bill. Really severe headshots that, you know, you kind of brush them off and just take them as part of the job. And then I'd say that all three of them were Bill's fault either. I, you know, the kick. kick was one, though, that was the worst. That was the one that tore a muscle in the back of my head. I've actually got a torn muscle in my neck that I guess is going to bother me for a long time. It'll never be the same. It's about, you can almost stick your thumb through the, there's like a small hole in the back of my neck now. So that's, he kicked my head so hard, and I don't think he was looking where he was kicking. And it's just another one of those moves that people do today that they don't put a lot of thought into the consequence of it. But that kick in itself has certainly cost me a great deal of money, and it certainly caused me a lot of grief physically, because I'd say he almost kicked my head off my shoulders, and his eyes are nowhere, they're not even looking at his feet. So, I mean, I went in open-minded enough, and, you know, I got kicked like a guy would get kicked by a horse, and it was almost like an uppercut with his leg if you watch it, and that was the worst one of the three. That one I think put me in a funk. Like, that was the fog. I was in a fog ever since, and I think I took him in my match with Terry Funk, for example. He dumped me out of a basket or some kind of wheeled container. In that hardcore match, and I hit my head right where the worst place I could hit it, exactly where I got kicked. And I think that was another big blow to my head, as was the last match I worked with Kevin Nash, and Sid came out. He chokeslammed me, which was that's when I saw stars for the first time, and I think that's where my speech was affected. And then he powerbombed me after that, and that was the, that was, at this point, hopefully it wasn't the last move ever done on me, because it's all both those two. And Sid was fine. It wasn't anything he did. It was just, I shouldn't have been in there. I had a concussion, and I should have, it just steadily got worse. And it's a shame, because I see what happened with Eric Lindros, and I'm reading about it. He's aware that he has a concussion, but he's not, you know, doing anything about it. And I really felt for that 3 weeks or maybe even 4 weeks that I had the concussion. You know, you could have talked me into walking across 8 lanes of traffic, and I would have done it. You know, it was like, I just was sort of blasé, and I didn't really think everything through. And, you know, in particular, there was that accident, potential accident I could have had in Salisbury, Maryland, when they asked me to drive a car out of the back ramp of the building with Bill Goldberg chasing me. That's where he punched his hand through the window.
Right, the Goldberg guy. Brett, we were talking about your injury and things like that. You know, Jeff Merrick was on the show actually right after you did the off the record thing, and he said that they wanted to ask a question and basically ran out of time. And that was with WCW cutting pay of people if they're out for, say, whatever it was, 30 days, and then start cut the pay. He felt, and they wanted to ask you, if that would obviously encourage guys to come back sooner than they should, which could lead to, you know, whether it be painkillers to mask injuries that haven't fully healed, or, you know, things of that nature. I mean, what are your thoughts as far as, you know, the cutting pay of if you suffer an injury on the job, you know, 30 days after the injury?
Yeah, I think that whole thing is totally bogus. I was never aware of the circumstances of that. I didn't do anything wrong, and I've been, you know, I know the injury, this injury has been, you know, hasn't been helpful to the WCW, but I think, you know, when they send me in the ring with somebody, you know, and especially someone like Bill Goldberg, who's the, you know, you like to think they're building the franchise around, and you go in there doing your everything possible you can to, you know, to make this the best match possible. And then you get hurt in the line of duty. I don't think it's unrealistic for you to openly, clearly expect the company to take care of you and protect you from but this, you know, it's not fair. You know, I don't think that's how it works in any other sport. And, you know, I think it's high time that you know, they treated wrestlers the same way they treat any other baseball players and anybody else that gets injured in this kind of situation. I don't know. It just doesn't seem fair to me, and I know that the WCW, you know, has taken care of and protected certain wrestlers during the course of an injury. And, you know, I think it's different if I got hurt on a motorcycle or something like that. but this is clearly a situation where I got hurt in the line of duty. So painkillers and all that, I mean, if I was in a really dire straits like I certainly was years ago, I would be forced to go in the ring at my own medical risk, and I think that's goes right back to my circus animal argument from a long time ago.
Now, one of the things, this brings up two things. Number one is the talk of a union, that you know, wrestlers have never had a union, and it's such a huge business now that it's kind of almost amazing that they don't. And then the other one is that with the nature of wrestling, the concussions are getting more plentiful. And I know you've talked about this in the past, but there's, you know, the new trends in wrestling are making it a lot more dangerous and a lot less skill-oriented than it was even 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes me back to my not-so-idle boast about being the best there is and all that. You know, I wrestled 22 years now, Dave, and you can nearly cite a wrestler anywhere from Japan to England to anywhere that I ever worked with that I ever physically hurt in a way where he couldn't work the next day. And I think I'm proud of that, and maybe my single greatest accomplishment in wrestling is I never injured anybody. The only guy I think I hurt was Bill Goldberg, funny enough, in a thing last year. I hit him across the leg with a chair, but I mean, if you watch the tape, you'll clearly see that Bill moved a couple seconds early. You know, when I'm in the middle of a swing with a chair and he moves, it's, you know, unfortunate, and he's still, you know, he's obviously learning a lot on the fly. But I mean, I've never really hurt anybody in my entire career. And now you see guys today, everyone's swinging chairs, and the fighting is less and less in the ring. You really should have danger pay or stuntman pay or something, because it's not wrestling anymore. It's not wrestling with headlocks and drop kicks. And, you know, you clearly know, I think wrestlers, at least I do, I understand the risk of, you know, injury in a wrestling ring to a certain degree. But you look at the wrestlers 20 years ago, it was hip toss, arm drag, you know, one tackle, drop down, get it again kind of stuff. And you really didn't get hurt. I mean, you got hurt in the old days wrestling on bad rings where you went down to one knee and it was like, oh, damn, you blew your knee out because there's a hole in the mat or something. But nowadays, the rings are pretty good. Guys are just wrestle safer. You know, it's escalated to a point where people are doing moves that, you know, and I wouldn't even say this is a very good average, but it's like I can do this this move 8 times out of 10, perfect. It's like, well, what about the other 2 times? You know, and it's become a common, nobody's worrying about those other 2 times. And I'd say the average is a lot less than that ratio. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of times it's hit and miss whether this somebody's doing this move or that move. It's, you know, he might miss you by 6 inches or he'll take your, knock all your teeth out. And your chances are about 50-50.
If you had a way, you know, we were talking about like retirements and things like this, and if you had a way to write your finish of your career now, what would that be?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's another one of those awful dilemmas for me. I envisioned after my brother's accident about coming back and how I started to kind of see how I would ride into the sunset a little bit, and I thought at least I was going to have fun, that sort of top heel spot, and carry the bell for a while, and I thought I was going to have great matches with Goldberg. I'd really look forward to working with Benoit as the next guy after Goldberg. That seemed to be the plan for me. I'll be honest, because I know I sort of kind of found myself criticizing certain aspects of wrestling, but in the end, I think I end up being pretty hard on Vince Russo in some ways. But I actually think Vince Russo did a lot of good at the time. And what they had laid out for me in general was, I was very happy with the way things were going for me as far as, at least it was becoming fun, and at least I had some continuity. So I don't know, if I stop now and look at it, it's really so hard to see, because I don't know. I'd have to have somebody throw some different scenarios at me. If you ask me right today, I don't see one scenario that I would want to jump into. And if I could design my own later on down the line, it's first of all, I don't have the ability to design my own further on later on. So it's, you know, I don't have as much of a hand in the creative input that, you know, with this company as I did with the other. Vince McMahon, you know, when we did work well together. We worked really well together, and he was always really receptive to most of my ideas, and we worked really hand in hand. And he, I think, you know, like he's done with everyone else, from Steve Austin and you know, various guys in the company. You know, we worked really well, and he brought the best out of me, and I performed really well for him. My problems with him came after that. But with the WCW, I haven't had that chemistry yet. I'm not saying it wasn't possible, because I kind of felt like I was on the verge of it before I got hurt.
Well, how was your feeling as far as, especially a couple weeks back when you went to England and you got that really good reception at those shows?
Well, it was really emotional because I waited a long time to go back, for starters. Same with Germany. I have a really solid fan base. And, you know, it might not be, I don't know if wrestling fans are that much of an abundance in England, Germany, whether it's just you take the whole country and whatever ones come to the venue or that area that do come and see you kind of thing. Maybe it's in the overall picture aren't that big of a portion of the worldwide audience. I don't know. But I know that for the ones that are over there, especially in Germany, but in England also, I had a really strong bond with, in the sense that when I was not necessarily over as the greatest thing in wrestling in America, maybe even a little bit Canada, I was the greatest thing in wrestling for sure in Germany and England, and they loved everything I did. It was the black leather jacket, the sunglasses, the whole, you know, it was the greatest experience I ever had as far as sort of the pinnacle of my career, and had the greatest fans in the world over there. Because, I mean, like I can remember Wembley Stadium, you know, the soccer chants that they gave me. They, you know, it was just way bigger and louder and different than anywhere else. Same with Germany, you know, where I literally had to fight and claw my way to my rooms in the lobbies of the hotel and stuff. And it was just girls that just were absolutely in love with you. And I always remember those things. So when I went back, I wanted to at least say goodbye. And I was, you know, I think I was being very honest in the sense that I don't know if I'll ever get back. I always want to go back. If I probably could, I'd love to finish my career and have my last match in Germany just out of, you know, gratitude for, I think that was the single biggest sort of portion of Hitman fans that I ever, you know, combined together was in those places. But in England, I noticed that when I did my interviews and Germany both, whenever I went out to speak, you know, they listened to every single word I said. I mean, there was not one could hear a pin drop kind of thing. And it was really nice to actually communicate with a large audience. There were both times that I, you know, especially remember like the big towns that they ran, even London. I got such a strong ovation and the reception was overwhelming. When I think of when I came back to Atlanta as an example, and again, I'm not bashing American fans at all, but I found that there were certain people in the audience in Atlanta that were very hard on me when I was trying to speak about Owen and different things. And I just realized the American audience is so much different than the European one and even the Canadian one. I spoke in Winnipeg a few weeks ago, and it was very much the same as Europe. So my old shtick about Canada and the U.S. still seems to apply, except for it's only a really small portion of the audience. It just seems to be very, almost kind of, I don't know, just kind of, they don't really give a shit about anything.
Well, the thing with the Atlanta thing is that, you know, if you watch that tape back, I mean, you got a really big ovation leaving, but there were a couple of slow points, and, you know, it really only took one or two voices, but those voices were very audible. I mean, it was pretty clear you heard them, and we all heard
it. It really threw me off. It made me want to just, you know, I don't think people, like a person like that, that maybe, you know, found that humorous, I don't think they know how hard it is to go out there and struggle to find the words to communicate on that kind of level. And so it's things like that. When I think about going back to, you know, Nitro and wrestling and all that, you know, I think sometimes I'd be better off doing a little video in the back, you know, filming something in the back and letting that air instead of having to put yourself through a, you know, where you just, I know it's much harder than people think.
Well, especially on that type of thing. You know, before we go to this break, I want to ask you, I guess your thoughts on Davey Boy Smith.
Let's get right to it, huh? No.
Well, I mean, just the whole thing. I mean, the whole story's come out, you know, him going back. I mean, I know that you and I talked once about him going back, and it was very different than a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, and I'm glad for the opportunity to clear the air on it, because I don't care that he's working there, and that's been misunderstood right from the beginning. I don't think Jim Neidhart's working there. I don't say anything about him. And even when Chris Benoit left to go there, you know, I left a lot of friends there, and I don't have any problem where they work or what they do for a living. And Vince is, you know, it's, I look at, you know, my brother's accident. Sometimes it's like a mining accident, you know, it happened in the mines kind of thing. But that doesn't mean everybody else can't work in the mines anymore. They, you know, they have to feed their families and that kind of thing. So I don't have any problem with Davey working for, he worked for whoever he wants to. My objections to Davey have been from him, the position he's taken in getting a job, in the sense that he's gone way out of his way to say that he, this is his opinion, I guess, that accident with my brother Owen was nobody's fault and nobody's accountable for it. And, you know, that Vince didn't push him is another line that he said. I think if you read the whole article that Davey, that was in the WWF magazine a few months ago, was very, clearly that he's on the other side of the tracks as far as my family and Martha and the rest of the people in the lawsuit and how he interprets this horrible accident with my brother Owen. All I'm going to say is that I personally feel that it's definitely somebody's fault, and somebody should answer for that. I don't believe it was my brother's fault. He should never have been put in that circumstance. And for Davey to basically posture himself to get a job, especially at that time, you know, here was Davey on Monday or Tuesday morning after the tragedy itself. Here was clearly on TV saying that this thing was nobody's fault, and it was, you know, that it was just an accident, and Owen understood the risk involved. And, you know, I look at that and I go, this, that's just so not true. There's somebody at fault here, and he was doing that strictly to get himself a job, and I take offense to that. So I think
he was pretty much like he was going there beforehand. I mean, I don't know if the ink was dry on the contract exactly, but was Owen involved as far as
him
opening the door? Owen and Mick Foley kind of were involved in opening the door, right?
Yeah, and I think I was aware of it, but the way even that was designed was that, and I'm clearly aware of it at the time, was that Vince offered Davey a job when he could get back on his feet. And, of course, Davey was drying out in the hospital or whatever he was doing in recovering. And there was a lot of, you know, it was a lot of consideration at the time that he would never come back, you know, that it was highly unlikely that he would be able to wrestle again. You know, then I think Davey, you know, he said such stupid things right away that, again, that you can only be offended if you're in the family, but to talk about going back and winning a title in Owen's name was, you know, it's not about winning a fake wrestling title. It's you know, it's really, that's almost an insult to his memory to think that you would concoct a storyline around something like that. He clearly saw this, in my opinion, Davey clearly saw this as an opportunity to take advantage of this horrible accident and turn it into a storyline or turn it into, and I find that really bothers me. And I think Davey should have stuck to the, you know, just by doing what Jim Neidhart did and most of the members of the family have done, but just not saying anything and don't defend Vince. And you don't necessarily have to trash him at this time or anything like that, but I mean, you should just, you know, maybe just stay out of it until the smoke clears. I mean, the Kansas City Police Department never, he was under investigation for at least 3 months for criminal negligence in this accident. They had to really sift through it and find out if there was, you know, what, you know, where the negligence really lies kind of thing. It was really a serious matter. And, of course, Davey was on the news on Monday going, hey, this is nobody's fault, and, you know, on to the next show kind of thing. And it's like, that's just not how I see it.
And I don't think we've actually ever talked about the subject, but the Dynamite Kid's book, I mean, I know you didn't like it, and what were your complaints with it?
You know, it's funny what people find that I didn't like about it. What I didn't like about it was I didn't think it captured what he was really like. And I know it was him that wrote it, but to be really honest, he came across like such a jerk in his book. And in fact, he actually was actually a much better guy than that.
Because he did come across like that, which I thought was, I thought,
yeah,
it
I think
was really
the same guy he was then, to be really honest. And it's kind of a shame. I remember the guy, you know, we right off the top, he was always a bully. Dynamite was always a bully, and he was always, you know, not the easiest guy to get along with sometimes. But at the same time, he was a very, he was a great guy, a great character. And he had all these great qualities, and he literally, he was a great, what they call, enforcer in the dressing room kind of thing. He weeded out the guys with the bad attitudes. Everybody loved him. And when I read his book, he raved about, you know, and I don't have anything against anybody he raved about, but he put over more guys that he went out drinking with were great wrestlers rather than how they were judged for their work or how much they drew money, you know. Dan Spivey was an okay guy. But he raves about Dan Spivey in the book like he's Ricky Steamboat or something. It's just not the same thing. I thought his own analogies of himself and his... I just thought it was a shame. He's obviously not the same guy that I remember from a few years ago. And he really missed... I just don't think he... He certainly didn't bring out his best qualities. And I think if I was going to write a book about him, I'd make you actually... You could actually like him.
Now, one thing about the book is that the book was probably, out of all the wrestling books, the most open when it comes to drug use of the wrestler, certainly in the 80s WWF.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's other guys who've kind of said stuff, but, I mean, he went into detail, and I don't know if he exaggerated his own use. I think he probably was pretty straight with it, and it was pretty shocking, I think, to people who weren't in the business who may have read it for the first time.
Yeah, in looking back on reading it, I didn't find anything he said in there was, unrealistic. There was, you know, whatever he was taking, steroids, and I think he was pretty honest about all that stuff, and I think he had no, you know, he didn't care who he offended by it, so. No, I think that was pretty accurate, the pills and all that stuff. You know, I hate to say he was one of the forerunners of that, or the... You know, he was very, you know, I think a lot of his problems today resulted from him not knowing he was hurting himself as badly as he was, and that was seems to be a prerequisite for so many other wrestlers in this business, is they get hooked on the painkillers, and they take them to get in the ring, they take them to get out of the ring, they take them to work out, they take them to, you know, they got to take this to sleep, they got to do, you know, it's an awful shame that it happens, and it's been happening for a long time. But I can think of far too many wrestlers that I've met that were pretty clean cut when I first met them. And then you see them around that kind of environment for not even 9 months, a year later, you see them in their, you know, because they're face down in their food, someone's helping them up to the room. So, you know, it's awful. And I think British Bulldogs, both of them were guys that, you take a pain pill and you squat, you know, a million pounds kind of thing. And, you know, they're suffering for today, both of them.
You know, one of the things about the book, especially towards the latter part of his career, that I found fascinating is, you know, especially after he had the big injury, and even a little bit before then, you know, you see this the portrait of this guy who, you know, obviously in his prime was one of the great workers, who is trying to, you know, he's in pain, and he's, as the years go by, in more and more pain to where he could hardly walk, and he's taking the drugs to stay in the business, to stay as high in the business until the point where literally, I mean, you know, he was in a wheelchair. I mean, the stories of him in the last year or two and how much pain he was in, you could tell, like, watching him, he wasn't the wrestler that he once was. But I don't think anyone realized just how, you know, how much he was doing just to get in the ring, and how, you know, really tragic the end of his career really was at such a young age.
Yeah, I when I think of him, I think of Dynamite. You know, I remember even when he worked for my father, his knees were shot. You have to understand, Dynamite was clearly a kid that was on steroids for maybe the time he was, what, 17 years old, and heavily into them, or 18 maybe. And I think Davey quite conceivably the same thing, but they got really young into steroids. They had great physiques when they were young, which had a lot to do with how they drew money. And of course, they were stronger, faster. they were really well-oiled machines when they were in their early 20s, both of them. And they made money and they did really well. But I often think now that it's my own experience with steroids, the limited use in contrast to them or comparison to them. But I think steroids, especially at a young age, deteriorate your joints. They give you a false security in the sense that you feel that you're indestructible all the time, and then combining that with painkillers. The way Dynamite bounced around the ring and the way he worked and how hard he worked, and nobody worked harder than him, there's no doubt. Like, when I think of how many, he broke his hands, he broke his elbows, he broke his shoulders, his neck, his ears were cauliflowered, his knees were shot, his ankle, there's nothing left. There was nothing, including the two discs taken out of his back. Nobody gave more to this business than he did. And unfortunately, I think, including his two front teeth, he gave it all, and in the end, he became a very bitter, sour guy when he couldn't do it anymore. And it's just a shame that he kind of missed his calling. You know, I feel a lot of sympathy for him.
What were your thoughts? In mid-January, you know, everything was going down with you. You know, you basically had to pull out of that pay-per-view as the champion a couple days before the pay-per-view, and then the whole thing with Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, and everybody, Malenko, all going to WWF, you know, pretty much actually spurred in its own weird way from your injury and missing the pay-per-view, and they were scrambling for ideas, and it, one thing led to another. Russo ended up losing his position, which he just got back, and Benoit and those guys, you know, Benoit, I guess, was your favorite opponent in the company, left. All this is going on within like a one-week period. I mean, what was your feelings while this is all going down?
Well, and I was basically a catalyst to a lot of things, and I actually really, really regret it. I'm really sorry that I affected so many different people that way, and I think that, again, results. You can just look at it like, geez, somebody kicked me in the head, and look what happened. There's so many different things. It was like a domino. You know, all these different things happened, and I certainly was a catalyst. But all I'll say about any of that is that I regret all of it. You know, I regret that I got hurt and it affected everyone like that, but I can stand by whatever Chris Benoit's decision was, and Perry Saturn, who I both have high regard for, and even Dean Malenko, who I like. I like all of them, and I respect their integrity. I don't know the circumstances. I never asked, but I know one thing. I just couldn't find any problem or objection to anything Chris Benoit does, and if he had objections to, apparently it's Kevin Sullivan or whatever his problems were. I don't know what they were, and I don't need to know. I just know that I have a lot of regard for him and his integrity and his word. If he wasn't happy, and you know, it gives you some respect for even Bill Bush. He's, you know, if they weren't happy, he let them leave, and he promised that, and he let them go. And I just feel bad, and from a selfish standpoint, that I, you know, won't get a chance to work with him anymore. And Perry Saturn, I wanted to work with him. The one match we had on TV was only about 6 minutes long. We were both kind of disappointed. You know, just those are both guys that I really look forward to working with, and I'm going to miss them. But, you know, the WWF is, I look at it strictly from an artistic standpoint, that I've always said to Chris that, I like the bigger ranks. I like the real ropes in the WWF. You know, I'd be interested to see. He's about the one guy that I really look forward to still watching. I don't really care what company's in. If that's an endorsement of the WWF, then fine. But I'll probably always watch Chris, no matter where he works. I just hope they take care of him. They got the best worker in the business.
Before we go to the calls, I just wanted to get one last question in. This was about 2 weeks ago, or whatever it was, the day that you were on the Off the Record show, which I think airs April the 4th. And they played the clips of Vince McMahon from Off the Record, I guess, from about July. And, you know, I mean, I remember listening to it when that thing was airing in Canada. And I had kind of heard what was said before it actually aired. And then listening to it, I got hot because I felt that, you know, he was trying to take this circumstance and twist it to almost like, I mean, he was blaming you practically for his media problems. And I just thought that was really to me it was a cheap shot, because whatever problems you and he had nothing to do with that accident at all. And a lot of people have tried to tie the two of them together as a way to perhaps, you know, justify his position or complain about your position or something. And I don't know, what were your thoughts like watching, you know, him saying that?
Well, I thought it was a real low blow, to be honest. You know, we met. I was very honest and open with him when I met him. I didn't pull any punches, and I don't regret anything I said to him. But at the same time, I saw this as a situation where you know, two you know, two very close friends at one time, somebody that I had high regard for and somebody I, well, I take that back, I had some regard for, somebody that, you know, I had, saw definitely as some kind of a father figure in my life, and I thought he would always, you know, he says on that documentary so clearly, I'll always appreciate what you've done for me. And when I met him that day on the, it was not a business meeting. It was two old friends going to speak, and the tragedy was, my brother, I think, called for that. It was like, who's going to worry about a silly old wrestling finish in Montreal when something like this is, it just overshadowed it so much that I felt that it was time to, I don't know if bury the hatchet over it, but at least there may be a chance to at least hear his side of it, or we'd never really spoke, and I was anxious to at least give him the time to speak to me like he asked, and I was told specifically by the lawyers not to talk about the case. That was the only concern they had, just don't talk about it, and really there was no point in talking about it, and as soon as I sat down with him, I said, you know, I'm sure you don't know any more than what the newspapers and the police have already, you know, sort of put out as what, the, you know, what they know is out there. And he goes, no, I don't know any more than that. And I said, well, let's not even deal with it. We both know there's probably going to be a lawsuit. And from that point on, I was very honest and open with him. I talked about my feelings about them carrying on the show. You know, I brought up, you know, how I wanted to... Hello?
Hello, yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, well, I wanted to, you gotta forgive me with the concussion. I get derailed.
Yeah.
Anyway, we talked about we started talking about what they did to me in Survivor Series. And I just brought up, so why did you do to me what you did? You know, I just... The boys kind of wondered why. There was no necessity for it. There was no call for it. There was no reason for it. I had a whole month that I was going to be there. I'd agreed to do anything he wanted. And even in the end, said, I don't even care. I'll put Sean over. That's, you know, that I just won't do it this weekend in Canada kind of thing. And you can clearly see how that would have hurt me in Canada. It would have really done, I think I've recognized in Canada now as a hero just for what I did do, the stand I made. And I think the documentary brought that out, which is some of it. It's only a blessing or a miracle that the documentary caught what they did. And it was never, when I flew home and they had the camera on me on the plane, I was so pissed off because I thought no one would ever understand what I went through and what I gave up and what happened. I had no idea that taped interview would come out the way it did, or that it would be, that they could somehow explain it into a documentary the way they did. So, I mean, I was really down about all that. And when I had a chance to clear the air with him and have just tell me, you know, why, he immediately told me he apologized. He told me it was the biggest mistake he'd ever made. He regretted it from the day he did it. And he gave me that big song and dance and I told me I had to finish my career working for him. And I sat there on this park bench and I really sat there and I wondered, I said, you finally got the sort of apology that you always kind of felt you deserved. And I said, maybe this is sort of a closure sort of thing. Like, maybe you can actually forget about it now. And then I just sort of felt myself going, I wonder if it's sincere. And it was from there that I went to the next issue of, which I was promised before I ever left that company, which was one of the most important things to me, was that I always wanted access to my archives and my film footage and my pictures and my history. I didn't want to lose that. That's why I never left. He knew that was you know, you just can't. I felt I was an artist. It's like being a singer, you know, writing all these songs and singing and all these hit songs. And then when you finish your career, they go, well, you can't sing any of those songs again. You can't play them back. You can't, you know, that was something that was, you know, just was my lifeline. I gave everything I gave my heart and soul to professional wrestling, especially working in the WWF, and I was proud of everything I ever did. So I asked him about that, and he promised me that then and there on the bench that he would give me unlimited access to all my archives and all my footage. And I asked for Owen's family and his estate, and I remember directly saying to him that I wanted this to be not, it had nothing to do with any future, you know, whatever happened with this lawsuit. And I said I wanted this for services rendered in the past. Exactly those words. And he promised me that there was no problem, and whatever I wanted was consider it done. And by the time I checked with him that week, his lawyers had told my lawyers that Vince McMahon did not recall that conversation ever taking place. and I never did get it, and I just saw, I said that he wasn't, didn't have any integrity for that right there on the day of the, before they put my brother, that he's directly responsible for allowing that to happen to him. Before they put him in the ground, he didn't have the decency to just stick to his word over that. And even that, it's like, what could it cost them to give me that? It's such a small thing to give me, and I think it tells you right there what kind of a person he is. Then for him to go on off the record, and I was very honest, he did have his conduct with me in the end of the Survivor Series did greatly affect my situation at home. You know, it caused a lot of problems for me on the home front with my marriage and stuff like that, which has since sort of corrected itself. But he caused a lot of problems for me. He caused problems for Owen. And it was all based around or centered around his lack of integrity right from the very beginning. And for him to dismiss me on off the record as a skeleton staring straight ahead with sort of a fixed glaze on my eye, my face and all that, I thought was really cold and a really insensitive thing to say. During that time, considering that I was kind enough to meet him. And he also implied on that show that I begged him for the meeting, which was also not true. It was an hour before the show, or before I met him, that he actually called and wanted me to meet him in his hotel room. It was Carlo DeMarco that said that he was fearful that I was going to kill him. And I said, well, for God's sake, why even meet him? Why even have a meeting if this guy is that pathetic that he thinks that I'm going to kill him? And, you know, just he's proved to be a very, when I think of Vince McMahon, I think he's a wrestling genius. I think he's a creative guy of, you know, I just can't believe that there was ever a necessity for him to be so dishonest and so cold-blooded, just a really a bad person.
And, I mean, the one question that I have is pretty much from the age of about 19, you've been on the road wrestling, either for Stampede Wrestling, WWF Japan, constantly. In the last year or so, between the torn groin and then the thing with Owen, and then this thing, you except for the one break after what was it, 96 WrestleMania, I think it was 96 WrestleMania, you really never had a big break. Now you've had a couple of breaks. I mean, away from wrestling, do you miss it? And now that you've had a chance to think about life away from wrestling, if that's so, is what happens. Give me ideas. What are your plans for after wrestling, besides maybe writing a book?
I don't know. I don't miss it. You know, I miss the cities. And I miss some of the wrestlers, but I don't miss the actual working at all, which is a shame because I think I loved it. Even when I think right now, like the only guy that really, other than some of the old guys, like, you know, funny, and I ragged on so many of these guys before, but I still would like to work with Hogan. You know, I'd still like to work with Flair. Because Flair's, I wrestled Flair somewhere, I think it was Lincoln, Nebraska, a little while back. It was great. It was fun working with him. It was like, so I saw certain situations where it was fun. I think that was just before I screwed everybody, turned heel kind of thing. So I suppose I was having more fun as a babyface. I could have fun as a heel, but I don't know. So I could have fun still wrestling. I don't know. But if I got out of wrestling, I haven't missed working with some of the green guys. You know, let me put it this way. Even working with Bill Goldberg was a lot like, you know, I felt like that Samsonite luggage commercial with the gorilla beating that suitcase up.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like the suitcase. And, you know, and there's no way around that. Bill's just, you know, he's just a powerful, explosive guy that when he power slams you or does some of those moves on you, if you think it hurts or doesn't, you know, if it's solid, it is. It does hurt. It is solid. And, you know, I literally finished that match in Starcade with Bill. I crawled back to my room and passed out with all my clothes on. It was a very physical match. Maybe I'm just getting too worn out. But I also look at how I work still at my age. I still go hard. And I still wrestle as physical and solid as just about everyone else. I haven't really slowed down that much. But I don't know, man. You know, and so that makes you really do consider moving on past wrestling. And, you know, I wouldn't mind getting into film, getting behind the camera, and losing wrestling and never having, you know, just change tracks. And, you know, I'll be grateful for everything I did in wrestling. And you know, it seems like at least a seems apparent right now that my real true archives, my best matches, and the great moments of my career will be lost in a vault somewhere in Connecticut. You know, if you've got some old tapes of it, you should treasure them because they're, you know, I think, especially the young guys today, I think they maybe should look back and, you know, watch some of the matches I had with Shawn Michaels in it for an hour, Stone Cold, you know, all kinds of different guys. I had some great stories. And maybe I could take that same imagination that I have in from wrestling and create stories on a different level, on a different stage, a different way. And I think that I can, you know, I can bring that out. And I thought a lot about getting behind a camera, you know, making some low-budgeted films, you know, that necessarily don't include me as an actor, but are more bent on, you know, bringing out maybe I could get some kind of funding, just say, here up here in Canada, nationally for certain projects, and I think well-connected with the industry up here. So it's just that something I would maybe be able to put my heart into. I'd like to do something intelligent, you know. I had to think about politics by it, so that I had an off-the-cuff market autograph session here in Calgary. And I made the sort of comment, they asked me about politics, and I didn't really have an answer, and I just said, never say never. And it took off as a national story up here, and they you know, want to know if I really considered politics. You know, I don't rule it out, only a sense that, you know, you just never know. I don't think Jesse planned on getting into politics either when he got out of wrestling. You know, sometimes your flair for being in front of the camera, the fact that you maybe have principles, and maybe you start to realize that you're not, you know, that you're not an idiot, and you have some ability to say what you want to say, and people get behind you. You just never know with politics, but I don't see that as being my game either. I think if I have had the problems with wrestling, it would only be magnified by the real political arena of politics. So I don't see that, but I don't know. I see it wide open, and I see maybe if I can't wrestle again and this concussion doesn't improve and it turns out that you know, I have to consider a different kind of livelihood, I'd probably just take a little time to, like you said, I have never really been home in 22 years. It's been quite an adjustment already dealing with being home and, you know, just the situation that I'm in. I go through all kinds of different phases from having to deal with my family and, you know, just having, you know, never been home here in the city. It's a whole new experience for me.
Let's go to the phone calls. Trent, I want to thank you for waiting for so long. You're first up with Brett.
No trouble. It's an outstanding show. Probably your best one ever, Dave.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank Brett, then.
Well, yeah, I'm just loving listening to it. Two quick questions for Brett. I know you're short on time. Firstly is, what were your favorite programs or favorite people to work with over the years?
My favorite workers? I didn't hear the question.
Like the favorite angles and workers, yeah.
Well, for sure, the two best things I did the whole time I've been in the WCW, which I think is what you're kind of getting at, is I loved the thing I did in Toronto with Goldberg with the steel plate. It was so hard to pull it off. There was a lot of you know, stuff going on behind the scenes, and I don't think anybody seemed to understand. Again, I think it was an excellent story, and it was a great little the closest I've ever come to any kind of a real. You know, I blew everyone's mind kind of thing with that. I thought it was great. I loved it. When I watch it back even now, I go, that was the only really great thing I ever did for the whole time I was in that company. It was such a pleasant surprise. And, you know, I was such a heel everywhere else, and I go to Canada, and I got that reaction again. I was so cheered. It was such a good it should have taken off and become a big thing, and they, you know, I still never felt they quite capitalized on that the way they did. And unfortunately, my brother's accident didn't help that either, but that was for me a great moment. If I could go back and live that, that was one of them. And the other one I always will be, maybe I think it's maybe my single greatest moment in my career, would be the one I had with Chris Benoit in Kansas City. Just from a personal standpoint, was I think it was the last great wrestling match of the of certainly of the year anyway, or the century or whatever. But like, just finishing it before the year 2000, all that was special. But
Sure.
Yeah, I don't think they're not wrestling like that anymore, and it was so much fun working with him. And if anything, I felt that he carried me a little bit. You know, I wished I could have even done more for. I wanted to give so much, but I've been off, and it was tough. You know, you just, I thought I did really, really well, and it was a really great match. But he's just such a great wrestler that I wanted to, if I could have wrestled him all night, I would have been. But all in all, I thought those are the two highlights of my WCW career, probably that and probably the pay-per-view where I won the title.
And also as far as, I think you also meant as far as, like, your favorite angles and stuff in WWF as well.
Oh, my favorite angles of all time? I always loved the whole thing with Austin. And I love the thing, you know, the saddest thing about the whole thing with Shawn Michaels was that Shawn was very much aware of where the storyline was going when we ended that thing in Anaheim where he won the hour match. Everything was on schedule. Like I said, I didn't know when I was coming back or even if my Hollywood rest my acting career taken off, which was sort of hopeful at that time. It was the groundwork was laid where I didn't shake his hand at the end of the match. I was going to come back and always have a chip on my shoulder about him. And I was going to cut these kind of little bit shoot interviews on him, and he was always going to. The whole thing was built. And it was supposed to happen that way. He was supposed to drop the title to me. He was supposed to come back and work with me in another match where I drop it back. When I look at that story and that angle and the way that whole thing would have built, and you can obviously see that I was right because there was such a tension in our interviews that if we'd just been smart enough to work it, and I was working. I thought we were right on target. And of course, poor Sean, he started to... You know, he got worked into a shoot, and unfortunately he marked out, and he's always referred to me as being the mark, but it's a shame because we would have done big business and it was all designed to make him. But that and the match that I had with Steve Austin, the whole storyline, I've never felt that I made Steve Austin or anything like that. Steve would have made it regardless of who he worked with, and I don't have any doubts about that. Steve was a great guy to work with. He's one of my favorite guys I ever worked with. I still really have a lot of respect and admiration for him, and I consider him a good friend of mine. But the match itself, the one we had at WrestleMania was, you know, basically I remember talking to him before the match and going, basically we're going to switch places in a few minutes. I'm going to be the, and it was all very sudden. You know, it was dawned on us right, kind of right then and there. And that's where the promotion was heading, and it was like, we're switching places. I'm going to be the top heel, and you're going to be the top babyface. And let's look at it from that perspective. And, you know, I think Steve and me sat down and kind of put that match together in very limited time, but very unselfishly. If anything, he was really considerate of, you know, and I don't know, the whole thing with the match itself, and that was one of the greatest matches of them all. And I'm really proud to have had anything to do with Steve's success after that.
One guy, you know, that reminds me of something is very, very early in Rock's career, you wrote something, you were still in the WWF, and you said you wrote something about, you know, looking forward to the day that you passed the torch to him. And, I mean, he probably had only been in the business for maybe a year, a couple months. It was very early in his career. And while everyone saw potential in him, the idea that he would be the guy to carry the company was in no one's mind. And the first or second time I ever thought about it was reading what you said about him. And what are your thoughts of him now that he's become such an unbelievable star?
Well, I same thing. I'm glad I had anything to do with it. I give him, I think, pretty good advice all the time. And in particular, Shawn Michaels, I really was really hard on him and tried to ruin him, really, and was jealous as hell of him and criticized him openly and brought, you know, whatever, and tearing him to shreds in the dressing room or some real small petty thing that happened in a match. He had great resolve in the sense that I told him, I said, don't pay attention to a lot of the criticism you're getting is strictly jealousy. These guys are really jealous of you. They see the potential in you. You know, and he overcame all those things. And he was a great athlete. Right from the beginning, you could tell he had just being a third-generation wrestler, and he's a legitimate third-generation wrestler in a sense. He really grew up in the business, much the same as I did or Kurt Hennig. Or, you know, he followed it. He understood it. His dad probably had wrestlers in direct contact with him all the time. I don't think he could ever escape it. When you have it around you like that, you really absorb it in, whether you like it or not. And I think he's clearly the guy that's going to be the main star in wrestling for a long time. And all I'll say about him is it's my, you know, understand it from all the time I've ever met him, that he's always been a leader in the dressing room. He's always been a team guy. He's always been, he's a great guy. And same thing, I've been really proud of him. When I met him last year before my brother's accident here in Calgary, I told him I was really proud of him. And I told Steve Austin the same thing. I don't have any hard feelings for really any of the wrestlers in the company. And it should be understood very clearly that it's been circulated that I'm trying to, which I have nothing to do with this lawsuit. And I just don't, that this lawsuit will bankrupt this company, and they're trying to almost put the guilt on the lawsuit kind of thing. There's no way that this lawsuit would ever bankrupt the WWF. They tried to sort of throw fear into the wrestlers and sort of make out that that I have such an animosity and hatred for the company, and I want to see everybody ruined. And I don't have any of those sentiments. I still care about the company, and there was a lot of really great people that worked there in the company, and it's just a damn shame that someone as smart as Vince McMahon is too stupid to have integrity sometimes when it really doesn't make any difference whatsoever. He's always had an opportunity to be a better guy. But the actual company, I'm proud of how I wrestle. There's all kinds of guys like Test that I started out, you know, Shamrock, and a lot of guys that are still affiliated with that company. Even now, Benoit, I don't have any problems with anybody working for anybody in that company. That's not what my problem is.
What are your thoughts as far as, you know, Canada, you know, especially Toronto area, they've really produced a lot of the young talent that's, you know, spearheaded the WWF's future, really.
Yeah, I don't know. Canada's always been a sort of a hotbed for wrestling. I don't know. Toronto, the eastern part of the country, especially right now. I don't know. Maybe it's the pride of knowing that Canadians have done well in it before. You know, even like Pat Patterson, for example, is Canadian. I don't know if anybody ever had a better mind for wrestling finishes than he did. Somebody of the really great minds in wrestling might have been Canadian. I don't know. It's an interesting way to look at it. I've always found a remarkable difference between Canada's wrestlers are always a little tighter, a little more solid, a little more polite, a little more shy. Like there seems to always be like guys like Benoit. I was a very reclusive kind of guy, I think, for a long time. They're always more humble, things like that. Tennessee, for example, a lot of the southern wrestlers are real, and it seems almost inbred in them. They can all cut interviews all day long. They're blessed with the sort of the being able to sell themselves better than Canadian wrestlers. But I don't think there's, you know, the Canadians always have had, and this is from coast to coast, have always been really solid, credible wrestlers more often than not. And sadly, in a lot of cases, were never considered, gifted in front of the microphone enough to make it. And a lot of them didn't make it in the States, but they were great wrestlers. So the style's always been prevalent up here.
Maybe that the American wrestling hero was always Hogan, who was more of a showmanship kind of interview guy. And, you know, you and Owen were probably the biggest Canadian stars, so these guys like, you know, Christian and Edge, when they looked at, like, a national wrestling superstar, you know, it was guys who were really good technical wrestlers, so that's kind of like maybe where their mindset started, you know, was with the technical wrestling as opposed to their mindset starting, you know, like by, you know, cutting promos or, you know, just going to the gym and lifting weights but not practicing moves, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, there's a certain work ethic anyway. Wrestling, you only learn what's in front of you kind of thing, really. So it's like what you're watching, which really for the last quite a few years, 10 years, it's probably most people have watched WWF. I mean, that's I think it's pretty clear. They were always been the strongest wrestling company for the longest time anyway, rather than the WCW who were on top for a limited time. But I think the style, wrestling style, and I think Vince was, you know, in the beginning was always very, I always thought that, like, Vince McMahon was like this wrestling fan inside. Like, he always seemed to, in my case as an example, he used to tell me, I don't want to know what you're doing. Like, other than the finish and the, knowing where the story's kind of going. And the match itself was my responsibility, almost from the time I worked with him. But in particular, when I was champion, it was like, I don't want to know what you're doing. Like Wembley, he didn't want to know what the finish was. He told me he wanted to watch it and see it. And I had that luxury for the whole time I worked in the the WWF. They really let me paint the picture, tell the story, and I don't think I did it, that anybody did it better. And I, you know, in looking at these Canadian wrestlers, they, you know, they had to have watched me, and they, I'm sure that a lot of them watched, you know, I know Jericho, for example, very much so watched Owen. And somehow we inspired them to be better wrestlers, which I think we did, and I think we also carried that on the other side of the wall, in the sense that in the dressing room we were, you know, I never found that we were complainers. We always, you know, we always went out there and gave a good match, and, you know, came back and had a pretty good time, you know, and made the best of the circumstance all the time, whether it was a long trip or bad weather or whatever. I think we always made the best of it. And I think we, in looking at a lot of the Canadian wrestlers, and Benoit's a great example, you know, he's just a guy that never complains, always goes up there and gives 100%. And they work so hard, and I think a lot of them, I can vouch for, on the same level. And this is goes to even Test, you know, and Val Venus, who I didn't train with or work with, but I've met him. And he seems a really dedicated guy that's well-spoken and probably respected in the business, and he's only been in it a short time.
Let's go to Ricardo in New York. Ricardo, you're next up with Brett.
Yes, hi, Dave. Hi, Brett. Brett, as long as you live, and it doesn't matter where you end your career, you'll always be seen as a WWF superstar and perhaps the best WWF wrestler in the 90s and maybe ever. Obviously, I guess that doesn't bother you, right? Despite the problems you had with Vince McMahon and the WWF, your heritage will still live in the WWF, and regardless, I mean, it doesn't matter if you don't have, you know, the WWF is trying to pretty much erase whatever you did in the past. Could you please tell me what were your thoughts when in that pay-per-view you had to lose the belt to Yokozuna, so Hogan could win it back from Yokozuna, from him? What happened backstage? Can you tell us something about that?
Well, I never, I was, you know, it's funny, this, the things that happened, I was always very frustrated with the match, in the sense that if you watch the match, it was a match that had two very powerful, like it was basically two matches combined together. And in that match, Yokozuna, he got so tired or fatigued that he, the wrestling term is blown up, that he cut out the entire second part of the match kind of thing. We just ended up going into the finish. So I was really upset after the match, only from an artistic standpoint, that he took it upon himself to eliminate the best part of the match for me. And I didn't get to sort of tell that story that I wanted. So it's like basically being a movie director doing a live show or something, and we ended up with a half the show that we wanted. But so that I was very angry. I remember I punched a wall and almost I cut my hand, I think, on something in the back. That was, so if it was ever interpreted that I was angry about the match, that was the reason why. As for the actual finish and being told, which I didn't find out till I think that morning, that I was losing the title, I really took it upon myself the day I won the title, because I'm one of the only guys, I think, that ever just walked in one day and they said, you're going to be the champion tonight. And that was quite a shock to me. I never saw it coming. I didn't have a chance to stab my way to the top. I just found myself in it kind of thing. And a lot of guys didn't have a chance to stab me before I got to the top. It just happened. And I promised Vince McMahon that day, and much the same promise I made to him every time I ever worked for him, that I just wanted him to know that I would never have a problem losing it to anybody, anytime, anywhere. And I didn't care what the circumstances were. I didn't care what the... And I was privileged and flattered that he saw that enough in me to put the title on me in the first place. So I didn't have a problem with it. When I did, he told me not to worry about Hogan, that Hogan was only going to do a tag team thing with DiBiase and those guys, I think, at the time. And he was coming back to sort of push a movie, and that was it. And I was not prepared for it. I walked in, and all of a sudden, everything was changed. And I was a little hurt by it and felt that I hadn't been given enough time. I think every champion that loses the belt that first time, like Kevin Nash, even
and you can go on and on at different guys that have held it and realize they didn't carry it, or, and you have a tendency to put the blame on yourself that, you know, you didn't carry it well enough, and you blame, like, you know, they didn't give me enough of a chance. I didn't. And I think all those things were true, and probably for everyone else, you know, they sometimes, you know, expecting it, it's a blow. Like, when I lost that title, it hurt. Like, I lost my position, which is another, here's another lie of Vince McMahon's that came out at the time. Was I remember in that meeting, I said, because I'd never flown first class. In those days, they used to fly the world champion first class. And, you know, it was the first time I'd ever been flying first class, and it was kind of, that was a big luxury for me at the time. And I remember when he, you know, let me know that that they were going to do this other finish and Hogan was going to be the champion. I said, does that mean I'm going to lose my first class? And he said, he laughed and said he would never, that I would never do that to me, and that as long as this company could afford it, I would be flying first class forever. And I said, well, I appreciate that. And I really didn't have any problem with it until I never flew first class again. You know, until I won it again. And I remember when I won the belt the second time, I said, so does this mean, I remember when he asked me to drop it the second time, I said, you're going to steal my, or not steal, but take my first class away from me again. And it was a, you know, we all had a good laugh over it, but I certainly never forgot that he openly lied to me then. So, but I, you know, I took it all with a grain of salt. I was, at that time, I kind of got a little, you know, I suppose a tendency to get a little bitter, and a little later on after that, like months later, when I realized that actually, you know, I was doing a pretty good job as champion, and I don't know why they had to pull the rug out from underneath me. And, you know, I think a lot of wrestlers experience the same kind of withdrawal symptoms, you know.
Let's go to Scott in Philadelphia. Scott, you're up with Brett.
Yeah, hi, Brett. This is Scott Goldstein in Philadelphia. First of all, I'd like to wish you a complete and successful recovery from your concussion. Hope everything improves for you. Second of all, you wrote a column in The Sun on the 7th of January, and I wrote a response to that. I sent it to you by email in a couple different ways, and I posted it on actually on the Wrestling Observer website. And really the issue that I guess at the time it just sort of struck me because I was very concerned about the use of baseball bats and how I saw it as unnecessary and a dangerous thing to portray constantly on wrestling. And some of what you addressed in your January 7th column sort of stimulated me to write to you and to sort of ask you whether you felt that some of what you had done in portraying using a baseball bat in the ring constantly, et cetera, whether you found that something that you regret doing or hypocritical to some of the statements that you made in the January 7th column that you wrote.
Well, a little bit, only from a, you know, myself, like I like wrestling for wrestling kind of thing. But I don't dictate policy in wrestling, and I was this moral crusader, I think maybe a little too much. And it's like I'm sort of tired of being the guy that complains about whether the direction wrestling's going. And then, you know, after a while, it's like, you know, people are going to watch whatever they're going to watch. I'm tired of, you know, I made my opinion clear, and I think it's a lost art, and it's an art, you know, that they better start respecting a little bit more. They won't have an art in wrestling. There's no art to using the bat and stuff like that all the time to the point that it's become something that has changed drastically, and maybe they should look at danger pay and all that because it's not the same thing. But as far as myself, again, I just, you know, I get paid to do a job. I reasoned that I wanted to go back and wrestle. You know, I understood clearly, and I hope that most people did, that it's a show now, and it's like a soap opera. And, you know, I, for the first time, had a big role in the show, and I didn't really want to be a heel, but I thought, well, if I can be a heel and you know, be able to allow people to let out their aggressions on me as a heel, and make, you know, and under the idea that it is a show, and this is I'm just playing the role of a character now, and clearly state that. So I kind of was torn between two things, but I tried to just do as I was told, quit dragging my feet, bitching all the time about, you know, the content and this and that, and just look at it as a situation as like, you know, can my kids turn on the TV, you know, and they haven't or really don't watch it much anymore, but if they did, and I was on TV, could they watch me? And I didn't have any problem with anything I did. I really didn't like the direction that my story, my character went. Sometimes I thought I just kind of took myself out of it, I guess. You know, like even that last day I worked in Erie, Pennsylvania, and I had a really, really bad concussion. I could barely talk, but I didn't know it. But that's where they had me out throughout the show. Kind of, I did actually a pretty good interview where, you know, I turned baby face that night, and I saw a lot of old grandmas clapping, and kids were really excited. I knew it was going to be a swerve at the end of the show where we all double-crossed Terry Funk and all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, I kind of regretted it, and I was like, geez, I'm going to be a real, you know, real jerk in a couple of minutes kind of thing. And, you know, and I said, you know what, it's wrestling. It's a show. I'll do what my part is, and I'll put safety as a priority and nothing else, and not worry about the, you know, if it hurts someone's feelings or something, maybe they shouldn't watch wrestling anymore. You know, I don't have a lot of control over that. Maybe, you know, I don't know. I'm. It's a very tough thing to be torn in trying to change things. And, you know, like the match I had with Chris Benoit as an example, people just don't want to pay to see wrestling like that over and over and over and over anymore. And that's a shame because that's what I loved about it the most. But I'm apparently in a minority, and most people would rather watch somebody drive a truck into the side of a car or something, which I just scratch my head. And it's, like I said, it's become something that is constantly changing. And what it is or where it goes from here, I'm not sure.
Well, we are completely out of time. I want to mention that Bret Hart's book, Bret Hart, The Best There Is, The Best There Was, The Best There Ever Will Be by Bret Hart and Perry Lefko is at all the bookstores. It's got photos of Bret Hart's career in WWF, WCW, title history, a lot of family pictures and things like this. And I want to wish you like a speedy recovery and just get everything back together. I hope, you know, like the headaches and everything go away. And if you can come back, that's great. And if whatever else, I just want to wish you the best of luck and hope that, you know, you can write like the encyclopedia of wrestling, because I know you've got more notes than everybody.
Well, Dave, I'll just say this much, that if I ever, you know, if I reach that decision where, you know, the end is near and I'm going to have to make that decision, I know you'll be the first one to know whether I ever like it or not. So, no, I'd be happy to, you know, I care a lot about the American fans and my fans in general everywhere, and you're the most recognized, legitimate, you know, reliable source in wrestling, and I'd be honored to be able to call you and let you be the first one to know if and when my career is over or when it's starting back, and until then, we'll talk.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for doing the show, and I want to remind everyone that tomorrow we'll be talking about Raw and Nitro. Wednesday, we've got Larry Matisic from St. Louis. Thursday, Jim Cornette. Friday, Chris Cruz. Monday, Taz. And we'll be back 6 p.m. tomorrow with Brian Al-